Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, SV Pod. Scott Van Pelt, along with Stanford Steve, bring you high-level sports analysis as well as stories as two dads raising their kids. Plus, find out every Tuesday what they hate to see if you agree. That's SV Pod. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Also, NBA Today, hosted by Malika Andrews, offers exclusive content Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. Alongside Malika, there will be a full cast of NBA experts and insiders, including Kendrick Perkins, Janae Ogumike, Vince Carter, Zach Lowe, Woj, Ramona Shelburne, and many of our NBA reporters from around the league. Get caught up with the latest from around the NBA on NBA Today on ESPN and the ESPN app. One app, one tap. And also available as a podcast. Listen to NBA Today wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about the latest with Kyrie in Brooklyn. Also, we've got If You Haven't Heard stories. But first, all right, so, you know, Sunday, your boy was a little bit busy. But, you know, we do a TV show that you got to tape and then do all that stuff and then send it down. And it makes you a little bit nervous because you never know if some news is going to break. You know what I'm saying? Like, you don't want to mess around and record a show. And then next thing you know, you find out Muhammad Ali died or something like that. Shout out to my homie Nuno if he's out here listening. Anyway, I was going to dinner last night, you know, celebrating with the folks about Game Theory. And we find out Tom Brady retired. Now, I don't know what the hell we was going to say about that on Game Theory necessarily, but it was just like, damn, dog, already? Like, you spent, what, like a month and a half with the fam and was like, nah, man, this is for the birds. I mean, I do imagine that it's got to be a very difficult situation for you if you're an athlete or one of these workaholic types, and then you get back to the crib and you realize that you don't actually like your kids. Like, you know, that's got to be tough. I feel like that happens to people all the time when they retire in sports. They retire, they get home, and they realize, damn, man, I'm raising a jerk. Like, I don't know if Tom Brady's raising a jerk or that's what happened to him. But, I mean, all you can do is hypothesize at this point about why it is that he would make that call when he made it. And I will offer you this hypothesis on that. I don't think that it was a matter now of I just want to get back so bad. Because, again, all we're doing here is guessing. I'm not pretending as though I've got some particular or unique insight. But if I had to guess about how we wound up where we are right now in this moment, is that if he changes his mind, he can change his mind. Like, it's a lot easier to change your mind right now as Tom Brady in the middle of March than it would be later, assuming, for example, that you want to go to Tampa. Now, there are not a whole lot of great quarterbacks in this draft. I don't know what the plan is for Tampa necessarily, but they're figuring out how to move on from Tom Brady. This is one great way to make sure that you got a chair in this musical chairs game. So, like, he say he gonna come back. Trust me, the Bucks will have him back. Man, he'll be like, yeah, come on down. What, look at Kyle Trask. Like, whoa, Kyle, yeah, come on, dog. Come on in here. But if you mess around and wait to make this decision until, like, after April, after everything gets shuffled around, then maybe this gets a little bit trickier for you. And while a bunch of teams would be willing to take on Tom Brady if they got, like, a space available, you're still probably taking on a guy who's going to be there for maybe 1 year. Like, that's all it is. And so if that's what it's going to be, go ahead and come back. Or it wouldn't shock me if Tampa told Tom Brady, like, look, man, we're going to try to take, like, Kenny Pickett or Malik Willis or Sam Howell, three guys that don't seem like they're necessarily ready to play right now. And they're like, Tom, look, come on. Say you're coming back, right? You get back here and you're not feeling it cool. Maybe we go to one of the kids or whatever. But we're going to need something for this 1 year. So go ahead, come on in here and make it happen. I don't really know. But even when Brett Favre would play this game, it would be until, like, training camp started and he started feeling like he was missing, you know, what his life normally was and the excitement that would be there. Tom Brady didn't even get into the summer. He was just like, nah, I was playing. My bad. I'm coming back here. Now, I got another thought on this, and it's more of a like broader philosophical sort of outlook about when you're playing football, are you doing what Tom Brady's doing? What exactly you're doing? Because I look at it, and whether it be with team sport athletes, boxers are a fantastic example of this. It's knowing when to walk away from the table. Now, Gabe, you do much gambling? You do much Vegas living?
Not really my thing.
Okay, so it's not really my thing either. And I realized that part of why like gambling wasn't really my thing was, you know, I was broke. You know what I'm saying? But I mentioned that because the amount of money you got to be willing to lose to really have fun gambling, I was simply not willing to lose. You know what I mean? Like you got to go into it willing to lose that money. Like I say, if I go to a table and let's say I put $200 down, I have spent $200, right? Like $200 is the cover charge. Maybe I come out of it with some of my money back, but I've spent that $200. I can't be in here trying to get this $200 back. That's just not going to work. You know what I mean? I'm here to have $200 worth of fun, and hopefully I'll get there. I'll be able to stick around long enough and have $200 worth of fun, okay? But when you look at it that way, it can be easy to walk away, but not really. Like, it can be easy to walk away when you get to the end of your $200 because the plan was always the $200. But it can be really hard to walk away when you're up because you're like, I don't even really care about being up. I'm just here to have a good time. You know, I walked in here with the plan of burning these $200. And I look at a cat like Brady and all these dudes, and it's like, yo, we're like, yo, why don't you go? Like, this is the chance. This is the time for you to go. Like, I remember when Kobe Bryant tore his Achilles in that game in 2013. I was like, yo, it gets no better. You tore your Achilles and you're such a warrior that you got up and made the two free throws. And then they pulled you out of the game. This is the time to walk away. But nope, he was going to run that thing all the way out. Now, it's a little different for Kobe because he made something like $60, $70 million in those years when he came back. But for a guy like Brady, I think a lot of us look at it like, dude, you're up. You've won 7 championships. You've won all the MVPs. You've done all this. You're up. Walk away from the table. Except for him, he's like, yeah, man, but you know what? I had planned to burn $200. And so I think for guys like that, they're willing to endure like the potential embarrassment of coming back and falling off. And I know everybody thinks that Tom Brady will never fall off, but everybody does. It's not possible to keep this up forever. And the cliff is often immediate. And while he looked better throwing the ball the last couple years, you go back to that last year in New England, and that didn't look like no dude out, you know, that didn't look like fame. He didn't look like he was going to play forever. You dig? Like, it did not appear to be that. But I just think he's probably looking around here and just like, I am going to ride this all the way out. Like, I think there was a quote from Muhammad Ali talking about the Rumble in the Jungle training, and that's the rope-a-dope training. And, you know, people ask him, you know, in the camp about taking all these body blows and all this. And the response was, suffer now and be a champion forever. And I think a lot of times for football players, they're willing to suffer later. Like for Ali, I think there was probably a level of suffering that came later that he didn't think was going to hit him. Because you go back and look at it, like the cognitive decline of Muhammad Ali came quick. I wonder if for a lot of these guys, this is what it is. They realize at some point their bodies were going to be terrible when they got out. All that stuff was going to be bad. And so what's the difference between playing this year and not playing this year? And so I think Tom Brady is willing to go at this until he can't play no more. And I think something that's also important to remember about a lot of professional athletes is part of why they could get where they are is they're not afraid of being embarrassed. Like, it would be heartbreaking and everything to watch Tom Brady be terrible. He's not afraid of being terrible. We're probably more afraid of seeing him be terrible than he is at being terrible at football. And so he's going to do just like all of them do, probably. He's going to play until he has no business being on the field. And we, from the distance at which we sit, have a tendency to look at that and be like, man, what a tragedy. And I think that Cat's in the position that he's in, they just don't view it that way. They just look at it like, hey, man, I got another opportunity to play. And they are perfectly aware that ain't nothing like what they're doing right now. That game, I don't know if I ever tell you this story. My brother tells about when he was in college. And he was aware while he was in college, life is never going to be better than this. You know what I mean? Like, he fully was aware of it. So they came to him one semester and they were like, well, Mr. Jones, got good news for you. It appears you are only 18 hours short of graduation. And his response was, cool, give me 12. He was like, I'm staying here as long as I can. It ain't never going to be as good as this. And for a guy like Brady, it ain't never going to be as good as that, I don't think. And that's what his world and life has been immersed in, is playing football. And getting away from that, I imagine, has got to be very, very difficult. Like, I think there are all those human levels that it comes down to. But I still think it's wild that it's happened right now. I still think it's wild that it didn't happen later. I would not have thought that the middle of March would be when we were hearing about this. And it's probably not like we're going to hear anything about, you know, like on the record about the decision making, though I guess he's got like podcasts and stuff now. So he'll go out there and give us as little as possible just to answer the question. But he had already started making that transition to like having his own brand and all the business stuff. And I just wonder, he got over there and it wasn't for him. Like, Abe, did you watch The Wire?
Oh, yeah.
All right, so you remember in season 5 when they tried to put Marlo in that suit and have him go to like them cocktail parties? Like, yo, man, I'm a gangster, man. You know, like this isn't what I do. Like, you've told me I can't be a gangster no more. And then he walks out and gets in the fight in the street because that's what he is. That's what he does. Tom Brady's not ready to stop being a gangster. It's not there. I mean, you can't be as good as he is thinking about other stuff, right? That's just not how it works. Like, you get to the level of excellence that he has achieved with hyper-focus. It ain't as much fun to hyper-focus on selling jeans. You know, you imagine Tom Brady trying to be excited when they bring him the new prototype of the Tom Brady jeans. Apparently, he sells jeans. I'm not using this as a random example. Apparently, he out here selling jeans. I don't know why I'd want to buy Tom Brady jeans, to be honest. I'm not saying I wouldn't want to buy Tom Brady jeans. I've just never thought about him and been like, yo, I want to wear the jeans he wear. Though I think we have previously discussed, I have no concept really about what is and is not nice jeans. Although I do admit, I put on a pair of jeans that I used to rock and I was like, oh, ooh, this does appear to be a lower level of quality. But like, if I wanted to wear Tom Brady's jeans, you know what those jeans would not be? Affordable. Because my assumption would be that Tom Brady's jeans are the kind of jeans you wear when you filthy, stinking rich. No damn well Tom Brady ain't wearing no jeans that cost $85. Not happening. It's not. So let's see how this plays out. I really want to see how it goes, like coming into this season, because we've seen people make the point, and I think they're right. Man, once you start talking about retirement, you basically retired. And so I hope it works out for him, honestly, because I got no reason to wish otherwise. But all we doing right now is guessing, and I'm guessing this doesn't end well for how I think of end well going. For Tom Brady, it's probably going to end the only way that I'd ever leave him satisfied. So, Gabe, apparently Kyrie Irving is at Nets games in Brooklyn, sitting with no mask, but he still can't play. Yo, I got to be honest, man. I didn't realize that New York had gone naked face. Like, I went to the Dork convention last weekend in Boston, and it was the day that naked face returned to the streets. Like, they had gotten rid of their mask mandate, and I got to be honest with you. I didn't realize how many of y'all were only wearing masks because it was mandated. Like, I wouldn't check it every day to see if I had to do it. It just seems like a pretty damn good idea considering the circumstances. Like, I did a quasi dice roll on having dinner last night with some folks. But I wish that there was some way for me to eat with a mask on, baby. I would have done it. Like, anyway, I don't quite get that. But New York is letting you go naked face again. And they're letting Kyrie come back in the building again and all of that stuff. But he still can't play because of the private sector mandate. And it is raising what I don't think is an unfair question is to make, you know, how does this make sense? And I don't really understand how it makes sense, to be perfectly honest. And the part that doesn't make sense to me is, why can't he be there? Like, you can show up at work and be around your coworkers. As long as you don't work, that logically doesn't stand up. So when I hear Kevin Durant talk about how logically it doesn't stand up, He's right. When I hear a lot of these people say that, they're right. Logically, it doesn't stand up. However, it doesn't change the fact that while the mayor says he can't unilaterally change the situation, there is still one person who can unilaterally change the situation for Kyrie Irving. Kyrie Irving, right? Like, even if I think that what they're doing doesn't make sense, and for me, it doesn't add up, it's not like he is trapped behind this poor logic. He can do something about it, and he won't. And that is his choice. Don't blame anybody else for it, though. And that, I think, is the point that we've reached, is to blame Eric Adams for it. Eric Adams is like, yo, maybe I'd love to do it. I don't know how much he'd love to do it, but he's like, yo, I'd love to do it. But no, can't. That would look ridiculous. So we're not going to do it. And Kyrie's like, oh, well, guess I won't. He just going to ride that out. But I'm going to tell you this, same thing I said on TV. Gabe, if Kyrie played for the Knicks, solutions would be derived. Like, in New York, it's a Lakers-Clippers situation when it comes to the Knicks and the Nets. It just is. And it's very similar in the sense that when the Clippers came to Los Angeles, they moved up from San Diego. They just shot right up to five, and they were there. But, like, ain't nobody asked them to do that. You know, like somebody just figured, hey, L.A. is so big, we could have another team, and we'll go from there. And that's kind of the same thing that happened with the Nets. The difference is, though, and where I've always thought the Clippers messed up, is that if the Clippers were going to do that, the Clippers should have moved to Orange County. Now, granted, at that time, Orange County was not necessarily the place that was going to be watching NBA basketball, given the perceptions of the 1980s. But Orange County is a different place. You understand what I'm saying? Like, saying you live in Orange County is not saying you live in Los Angeles. You know, Orange County people might have been into LA stuff and wanted their own identity, but it's not the same place. Brooklyn and, like, Manhattan, not the same place. New York City, same place. And one of the few things this whole city kind of agrees upon is the Knicks. Like, it is one of those things that brings the whole city together. And so you move the Nets from New Jersey, which is a distinct place, let us be clear. You move from there to Brooklyn, and maybe there'll be a generation of people in 30 years who are from Brooklyn and have grown up the whole time with the Nets being there, and the hipsters, like, will develop their roots, the gentrifiers, because the gentrifiers love the Nets. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're like, yeah, we're the new Brooklyn. You know, like, they the ones. They love that stuff. But they don't capture the attention of the city. The Nets can win a championship. Like, I would love to see what a parade looked like for the Nets to win the championship. Like, how many people are really showing up? Like, hey, you remember in L.A., it's like the Lakers come on KCAL 5. The Clippers used to just come on cable. Like, that was it. Lakers fans didn't even hate Clippers fans. It was just like, oh, okay, good for y'all. You won a game. That's what's up. That's what's up. Very patronizing stuff. But that was what it was. So, man, if Kyrie played for the Knicks, and they had a real chance at winning that championship that they have been wanting to win now for 48 years, or 49, excuse me, 49, I believe. Changes would be made. Things would be shuffled and rearranged. It would be different if he played for the Knicks. But he don't play for the Knicks. So he just going to be sitting over there naked face, and it ain't going to make no sense. None whatsoever. And I don't mind. I don't mind. I don't need it all to make sense. And again, I guess part of that for me is I've never found the things associated with these mandates to be great impositions. I just don't. I don't think that any of the stuff that we've been asked to do is that hard. And I don't think the people who feel that way think the stuff is that hard. They just can't stand the idea that somebody told them what to do. That's it. That gets us back to where it is. But I'm going to tell you this. Kyrie does come back, ladies and gentlemen, it's a problem for somebody. It is a problem. Like, let us go take a look at these here Eastern Conference standings. Because the last time I looked at it, it looked like the reward for having the best record in the East could very easily be playing the Nets. And Gabe, if you look at the standings right now, it's a percentage point difference. But if the playoffs started today, there'd be a play-in game between the Raptors and the Nets. that would be in Toronto, meaning Kyrie would play. And if they played that game and the Nets won, they would play Philadelphia in the first round. I got to say, I'll watch. I'll be highly intrigued. By the way, is Ben Simmons going to play? I think they said he had some kind of back injury. That was the explanation for why it is that he could not play in that game in Philadelphia. Though I just have to say, maybe his back hurt. You could maybe relieve some of the pressure by taking off a couple of them big-ass chains. Them chains would have me walking around holding my neck and back. Like, wow, man. You know, those are some serious chains that he had on there. But yeah, no, we don't necessarily believe what they're telling us is what the problem is. But can he handle? And I think this is a fair question to ask, even if you take the most sympathetic outlook to like how it's gone with Ben over time. Can he handle playing four games in Philadelphia? Like, I personally would not have traded for a dude that seems to have a mental issue that stops him from playing against one of the best teams in our conference. Like, if it's hard for you to play against the Utah Jazz and we the Nets, oh, okay, yeah, that probably won't come up. We don't be wanting to go over there neither. You know what I'm saying? Maybe. I don't know. Do you feel like you have any idea who's going to win the NBA championship? I have none whatsoever. And I don't know if that makes things more intriguing, because I feel like from a distance, if we don't know who's going to win the championship, or we do know who's going to win the championship, it doesn't really matter, because once you get in the playoffs, you still have series and there's still the anything can happen factor. And no matter how good a team is, if they get down in a playoff series, we could still like get charged up and get into what it is. The NBA wanted parity like the NFL, but you don't have single game elimination. So the parity, I think, has a lesser value for the NBA. Like, I don't think it's great. The former MVP is on a 5 seed after playing better than he did the year before. You know, but that's what's happened with the way that talent has been spread out. Like, it's almost like if college basketball has 7-game series at the end, you wouldn't dig that. I just don't think that would be the bag that you wanted it to be. But the Nets, we still have no idea what to do with them. And the Nets, I don't think, have any idea what to do with themselves. And the one person that could give clarity to that still is Kyrie Irving. It ain't no Eric Adams. It ain't no Kevin Durant. It ain't no Bill de Blasio. It ain't none of those people. Kyrie could go stick his arm out. I mean, although I imagine, Gabe, them vaccines must be getting dusty. Like, if you ain't got it by now, like, I've given up. I've given up on you. Kyrie coming there to get a vaccine. They were like, damn, sit right there. We got to go look in the back and see if we got any left. I hope it didn't spoil.
Ooh, I just packed these boxes. Do you mean I'm going to have to unpack those?
You don't really want it. I mean, come on. If you really wanted it, you'd been here by, you'd been done this by now.
Try the place around the corner.
If you haven't heard, it's brought to you by the new Love Your Car Guarantee from CarMax. CarMax, here to innovate.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bo, this first story comes from transportation.
Hi, I'm David Wickert with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. In Georgia, it's against the law to hold your phone while driving. You can't have it in your lap either. It's dangerous. If your eyes are on your phone, they're not on the road where they should be while you're driving. Well, last week, the Georgia Senate considered a bill that would have allowed you to touch your phone if you're at a stoplight or a stop sign, as long as it was mounted on your dashboard or your windshield, not in your hands. The bill's sponsor said he wanted police to focus on drivers who touch their phones while their vehicles are in motion. He said you can't hurt anybody if your vehicle is stopped. Safety advocates, police chiefs, and others strongly disagreed. They said the phone is a distraction, period. They say you should be focused on driving even when your vehicle is stopped. And of course, this is something that drives people crazy. You're at a stoplight and it's turned green, and the guy in front of you is not moving because he's on his phone. Well, the Senate didn't think too highly of the bill. It was overwhelmingly rejected. Now, I hate to say any bill is absolutely dead until the legislative session ends at the beginning of April, but if last week's vote is any indication, you're not going to be able to touch your phone at a stoplight in Georgia anytime soon.
All right, so, you know, these cell phone don't touch them while you drive rules are, I think, a really big deal and absolutely should be in place. Because, you know, you got these studies that'll say that texting while driving is as dangerous or more dangerous as driving drunk. And I don't think people like to talk about that because DUI is a crime of morality, right? It is a crime that allows us a measure of judgment. You know, you shouldn't have done this. And it really, to me, just sweeps in with all of our backwards, confused views in this country about alcohol and our difficulty it, like, we don't want to say that alcohol is bad. We just want to dictate that everybody behave 100% properly when it comes to alcohol. Like, you never hear anybody ever say, hey, man, use crack responsibly. It's just like, no, crack will mess you up. Look at all these people on the street, da, da, da. Like, we can't do that with alcohol. You know what I mean? But, like, that's what it comes down to. But I mentioned the fact that it's seen as a crime of morality, because if text messaging and doing all this stuff and playing with your phone while you drive is as dangerous as these other things, then we should treat it the same way if what we ultimately want to do is prevent it. But we don't, in part because so many people do it, right? In part because people have measures of, like, phone addiction, you know, like, that's just all it is. But I can't be mad at any law that's like, no, not even at the stoplight, baby, leave it alone. Let it go. And it's hard for us. And honestly, the lives that we live, like, for me, being away from the phone for 45 minutes, for me, is less about, like, I just need to be on it as much as somebody might be hollering at me. Like, it might be something I need to know. It might be something I need to jump on. Like, all these things, we got all these reasons that have made the phone, like, such an essential thing. But there are times where we need to leave them bad boys alone. And in the car is probably one of them. And so for Georgia to just be like, nope, 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 sorry, we're still going to make this illegal. So this is the quote from the guy. He says, my man said that the law makes criminals out of law-abiding citizens. See, you see what that is? That is a morality discussion, right? That is, wait a minute, these aren't bad people. And it's not about whether or not they're bad people. That is about basically who you characterize as being someone who breaks the law. And someone who breaks the law is somebody who breaks the law. And this guy doesn't like the idea of them saying that these good old regular folks might be breaking the law while they're behind the wheel of an automobile, making things unsafe.
All right, Bo, this next story comes from Arts and Culture.
Hi, I'm Dipof Alian from Vice World News and the author of the upcoming book, Africa is Not a Country. The Smithsonian has promised to return all of its stolen Benin's bronze artifacts after striking a major agreement with Nigeria. The artifacts are part of a haul of thousands of priceless treasures that were looted from the Kingdom of Benin, now part of modern-day Nigeria, in 1897 by the British Army. The entire global inventory, collectively known as Benin bronzes, consists of brass plaques, ivory tusks, wooden ornaments, figurative tableaus, sculptures, and brass commemorative heads. The treasures will be sent back to Nigeria, where they'll be displayed at the National Museum of Benin City. As part of the agreement, the two museums have agreed to a series of long-term loans and cross-cultural collaborations that will see the Smithsonian continue to display some of the bronzes. In the decades since the theft, American institutions like the Smithsonian have gained their bronzes through purchases and donations. The Smithsonian's decision to repatriate its entire collection of 39 bronzes highlights the fact that most of the looted treasures are still being hoarded by the West. The British Museum in London holds around 900 bronzes alone. And it's not just Nigeria that's impacted by this ongoing colonial theft. A 2019 report commissioned by the French government found that 90% of Africa's material cultural legacy is being kept outside of the continent, almost entirely against the will of the countries they belong to.
Yo, here's the tricky thing about this for me. And I love a good museum, Gabe. I am sure that you too love a good museum. But when it really comes down to it, what makes it so offensive, the way these Western countries handle these artifacts, is y'all ain't doing nothing with them. You know what I mean? Like all you doing is putting them in a case. And hey, maybe it gets back down there and all they gonna do with it is put it in a case. But it's theirs. Like, y'all gaffled them for the stuff. Why? So y'all can come look at it. And I certainly understand the idea of, like, cultural preservation and everything else. But one, those people are capable of preserving their culture and probably would care more to do it because it is, in fact, their own culture, right? But the arrogance of the idea that you're the only ones that can preserve it, and in the end, is just so y'all can come and look at it and say the stuff is pretty. Like, I go to the Met. Gabe, you ever been to the Met's Egypt exhibit?
Yes.
It is, first of all, it is bananas. Nobody was farther ahead of everybody else than the Egyptians. And wasn't nobody stunting harder than the Egyptians. And I appreciate the fact that I can walk and go see it. I really, really do. Like, I'm not going to pretend as though I don't see the benefits of having those things in the United States, for example. I 100% get it. But y'all know y'all stole that stuff, man. Y'all know y'all did. And they're like, yo, y'all know y'all stole it. Can we get it back? And, like, can we get some of it back? You know? And people are like, yeah, but we like to look at it. Like, that's it. It's not like these people, like, actually care about African culture. It's not like these people actually care about African people. They just like the fact that they can study. It's basically like going on a safari, right? Like, these are like bringing back tusks or whatever. Because you killed an animal out there and you want to show how exotic and body-bodied you are. And that's sad.
Dude, 90%?
Yeah. They went and just took what they wanted and took what was good and just left scraps in every single way. Like, the colonial devastation of Africa is something that we just don't talk nearly enough about. This is just the tip of the iceberg what we're talking about here.
All right, Bo, this last story comes from business.
This is Jesse McKinley from the New York Times. This week, I reported that the state of New York, which passed a legalization bill last year to make recreational adult-use marijuana legal in the state, finally finalized their plans for giving out licenses for these dispensaries around the state. And in somewhat of a surprise for some, the state has opted to allow the first tranche of licenses to go to people who have had previous interactions with law enforcement, i.e. convictions, on marijuana-related offenses. This policy is in line with the law that was passed last year by Albany lawmakers, but was still welcomed by a lot of advocates for reform of drug laws and liberalization of drug laws, and should result in dispensaries opening up around the state of New York by the end of the year. Now, this group of people who have marijuana convictions will probably number somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 to 200 licenses when all is said and done, and the opening of their dispensaries should come by the end of the year, with bigger, kind of more corporate players coming online shortly thereafter.
All right, so I have two thoughts on this, because it's appreciated when they do this, and I need to look more into this, but these marijuana convictions have ruined so many people's lives. And so my question is, how many of these people that fit the description, you know, fit the criteria, have access to enough capital and like the right friends and all that stuff to actually do something with this? Like, I'm not saying that rhetorically. Like, I say that as a real question. Like, I'm very curious about how attainable that truly is for a lot of those people. And then I have question number two, which is, did you say dispensaries by the end of the year? Like, the end of 2022? That's pretty good news, buddy, for the economy. You know what I'm saying? Like, people can get out here and make a little additional bread. I see a lot of storefronts closing and everything. It's not very good for the city if you have closed storefronts. So if they can get out here, give some criminals some work. Hey, man, criminals need work too. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, come on. By the end of the year? Hey, man, I ain't gonna lie. I would be a little salty that they're not arresting people for this no more, because I'd go out there and get popped so that I could come and get me a license to open me a dispensary. Can I go get popped in another jurisdiction and then bring my conviction in? Like, go down there and be like, just standing somewhere, standing in front of the police station. Excuse me, would anybody like to buy some marijuana? I would like to be arrested right now. And there is no need for a trial by jury. I will plead guilty tomorrow. Please give me conviction paperwork. And then ride up to New York and be like, I would like a store, please. Could that work? Because I'd give it a try. I think it'd be worth the risk myself.
Or at least the right to be able to have a store. But then you can even have someone else run it for you.
Yes, that's a great point. That's a great point. I'll just tell you, though, generally speaking, if you yourself are not capable of running the store, I'm not sure who you know that is. Just a thought. Like, if you ain't got the money, but you want a store, nah. That person gonna steal from you.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. Big night last night.
Yes, sir.
Super proud of you. What I wanted to do here is I wanted to reach out to some friends of the show, hear what they thought. So our first one comes from Patrice in New York. Here it is.
Game theory with Bomani Jones was everything I think everybody hoped it would be. The hard-hitting, unflinching view of sports and American society and race was awesome. The field segments were amazing. Oh, the Coach K stuff? Kill me. Brittany Griner laying on the top bunk with her feet flat on the floor. Come on, man. But I was really impressed with Bo's ability to relate to people in the man on the street segments. I mean, that was pure comedy. And they shot it beautifully. That black and white with the blurry, the shallow depth of field. Man, I was loving every piece of it. Every bit of it was amazing. Stephen A. Smith interview. Man, that dude was a little scary when he starts talking quiet. But anyway, man, you know, 4 stars, 5 stars, 10 stars, rate it however you want to, man. Joint was on point. Good job. Well done, Bo.
Man, Mumba was with me as my brother. I had him come shoot pictures. Like, I can't wait to see him. Like, I wanted to lean in on the day. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wanted to document it and get pictures that everybody, not just like pictures of me, you know, like I wanted to get the whole day. He was there. My agent was there. Like, it was real cool to have my people there, you know?
That was a really good idea to have Patrice come and do that for you, because that's almost having a friend do photos of your wedding.
Yeah.
They add to the experience who you'd want them to be there anyways, but then they're the one that's taking pictures.
Yeah.
So they get that more intimate side of you as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was good, man. It was good.
All right. This next one comes from Mike in Chicago.
Bomani Jones, when I first met you, I was a big fan of yours. You came up in the world. You're doing big. I love the show. I hope everybody else loved the show. It's just like the Bomani Jones. You ran it like Bomani Jones should run the show. I like that. And Bo, I'm proud of you, man. When I met you, you had no hair. You're moving up in the world. You're dressing good. You're dressing like us in Chicago. Gangster, baby. I like that. Now I got to get you in a fur coat and get you in some of them nice glasses. And you go hang out, baby. Bo, you did good for yourself. Real good. I can't wait to see the next episode. Hey, Bo, bring the HBO Max to Chicago and we can hang out. And then you can put some fashion and some color. You know I'm like a color. I'm like a crayon box. Thank you very much, Bo, for being my friend. God bless you, man. I love the show.
Man, Mike called me Sunday, said him and the fellas was getting together and that if anybody was having trouble checking it out or didn't have HBO, to let him know that he could bootleg it or would even pay for your subscription. Like, when I tell people that I love that dude, I'm not exaggerating. You know what I mean? Like, for those of us who go way back with Mike, if I go to Chicago, I'm going to catch up with Mike. You know what I'm saying? Like, Mike ain't just some dude that randomly calls here. Like, yeah, man, I'm not here without Mike. Like, I really mean that. I sincerely say that. And the man has never asked me for a thing.
All right. This last one comes from Roy in New York.
Yeah. This is your boy Roy Wood Jr., a.k.a. the number one hater. That Bo Money was all right, You know, he had a nice haircut, had a nice set. He had some folks working for him, got a lot of diversity and inclusion on that set. And Coach K was all right. You know, it's clever, you know, original and thinking in a way to tie race into something while also somehow still celebrating Coach K and giving him the respect that he deserves as the John Madden of college basketball. It was all right. You know, I DVR'd it and tweeted about it a couple of times and make sure all my people know. But other than that, it was all right. Oh, and another thing. Bomani talking to Stephen A. Smith and revealing sides and layers of that man while also not compromising who Stephen A. was as a person. It's cool to see two black men sitting down, talking shop, and being real with each other and not being all buttoned down like them white folks want you to be. Man, that man kept it real as hell in that interview, man.
Man, Roy, I don't know that many people that know that much about this world. And so in this process, he's really helpful, you know, and just kind of calling him and thinking about some stuff and thinking about, you know, who to get on the show and all of these things, you know, and actually a person that gave me some confidence that I could do this in the first place, whether he realized it, because, you know, I'm not a comedian and I'm not trying to be a comedian. But even before this was a possibility, him letting me know that like the rhythm and the way that we do things could transfer into like a type of format like this, like really is part of why I wasn't nervous at all on Sunday. For me, it was like, you know, like come to sit down right here. Okay, cool. Well, we're just going to do that somewhere else. And it was like the easiest day and just like a total celebration because of that, you know? And so somebody like him let me know that I need to go out here and do nothing terribly different. I just need to do me. It's fantastic and helpful. And I appreciate that.
Happy to see you doing your thing.
Dude, I appreciate it. And I thank everybody who took the time to check it out. Like I said, we got 5 more of these. I'm not really tripping on the rest. Like it felt so good just to do it and to hear from people. Like some of my best friends were with me last night, you know, for dinner and for watching the show and watching with my brother and his wife, who like they got me a big like movie poster of the key art for the show, the joint with all the colors and stuff, you know, that was in it. By the way, I told y'all that intro track was going to be a monster, didn't I? Didn't I tell you that intro track was going to be a monster? And so I got the Just Blaze beat. I hit Bun B up and I was like, yo, I'm trying to get in touch with Just Blaze about a beat. And so I've been talking to Bun a lot about the process, and he's been incredible, like as he is for everybody. And on Saturday night, Bun sold out the rodeo in Houston. Those of you who don't understand, the rodeo, a big deal. That's 72,000. That's at NRG. You know, that's at the stadium. Like, it's a huge thing to sell out the rodeo. It's a big cultural staple in Houston. And he was like, we all coming up at the right time, you know? He's like, hey, I got this thing on Saturday and I got this done and you got yours on Sunday. Dog, the idea that Bun B is saying that what I'm doing is in any way parallel to what it is that he has going? Like, where I say thank you, honestly, and it was like while we're doing the show yesterday and even in the responses and calls and stuff, separate or absent of how good the show was or wasn't, like, a lot of y'all are really happy for me. And that ain't something anybody has to do, you know? And damn it, two episodes in a row. Two out of three. Okay. Most of you know I'm not good with, like, compliments and, oh, this is so good and everything else, because I just believe that you have to be grounded in how you feel about these things. Like, it's not a dismissal or I don't appreciate the nice things that people say, but I just think it's very important to be grounded in what you think about this. If you don't think it's good and other people do, you kind of need to stick with what you think about it. And, you know, maybe I go too far in regulating that, and I know that it can seem rude and I don't mean to. It's just kind of how I keep myself grounded in everything that we do. But being happy for me is something completely different. That's something that's not necessarily tied to, like, what you think of the content per se in terms of just, like, quality. It's not about that. That's about a feeling. You know, that's about relationships. And I think I would like to think that that's about what I think is probably the most important thing for me is respect. And I don't mean like respect in a hierarchical sense. I mean, just I feel like the happiness from other people that I'm hearing, it feels like a reflection of not just a respect for me, but hopefully an appreciation for the respect that I have hoped to have and demonstrate to the people who have been around this for all of these years and everything that we're doing. And this podcast in particular, I'll be honest with you, what we've done on this podcast in the last 2 years has really done a lot to affirm my confidence and my belief in, like, a certain type of content that could be done and not just be good, but also be successful. Like, I can tell you this about this show, and Gabe will tell you I'm not lying. From 2019 to 2020, we experienced, I don't know the proper adjective, but I will say an uncommon amount of growth. And at a time when the whole industry was down, we were not just up, but way up. But then the next year, because the way they measure growth is year over year. So if you have like a bomb year, it's hard to grow over that bomb year. We had another big growth year the year after that, 2020 to 2021. We're in 2022 and we're having the best year that we've ever had in terms of people consuming this podcast. And what we've done since 2020 was lean in more and stop, like, trying to court an audience and more serving the audience that we had and just leaning in on what it is that we do and what it is that we do best. And first of all, thank you, Gabe, because that's a lot of his ideas and a lot of his thoughts on, like, hey, man, let's focus in on, you know, we looked at the numbers, we saw what people liked. He did a lot of research, you know, to find out what it is that you guys wanted from us. And it honestly affirmed a lot of what I think I've always thought about what I do. Like, all these people to try to act like the stuff that we put out here is like some kind of outlier and like so far afield in some political stuff or whatever it is. No, I feel like we're right where people are. Like, I feel like we are right where y'all are. Even me being the way that I am, I'm right there where a whole lot of you white folks are. I know that we got a lot more in common than people give us credit for. I know that we do. And I know that people can understand what it is that we're doing. And so we never leaned in and like trying to like pander to white people. I want to be clear about that. but we didn't always lean in on like, yo, this is what the right time is, and this is what it's always going to be. It was kind of like, hey, we can get a guest that maybe will show some other people about our show. And it's like, no, we're going to have our party all the time. And that affirmed me in making this television show and being like, no, we're just going to lean in on what we want to do. Like, we know we give some thought to like audience stuff. Like, we're not sociopaths. We're not idiots. But we leaned in on what we were going to do. And the legitimate support, I don't know how many people support whatever I do or whatever, but the sincerity of it for me is such an informing thing in what we're doing. And so I looked up at that show and I saw what I think a lot of y'all saw, which is, yeah, man, that was mine. That's my stuff. Like, that's what I think about. These are my ideas. And most of them worked. I mean, I think they all worked. But even if you don't think they all worked, I bet you think most of them worked. And we got more. And we're going to keep going. And I stood there after we got in there and they brought out like the champagne and the cake, and I opened the champagne bottle and held it up. And I looked around at this whole team. Some of these people I didn't even know until a couple months ago. And maybe I'm wrong. I don't want to speak for them, but I saw people that were legitimately happy for me. Not just like, yo, this is a good show. This is a good job. I'm going to get an Emmy. Like, looking at me and saying, yo, good for him. And that is honestly more gratifying than anything else that could come out of it. So I appreciate the fact that something that is really just for me also feels like it's good to you. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.